Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 66, section 5, which is old single column, page 745. All right, they've been giving us all of the general issues about the planetary prince, a little bit about his non-corporeal staff, quite a bit more about his corporeal staff, because, of course, that's the basic means for that dispensational revelation to engage those to whom they are revealing, the mortals of the world. So you need that corporeal staff so that you can have a direct material engagement. And that's led us up to this extended section that lays out, one at a time, the 10 divisions into which those 100 corporeal staff members are divided. 10 of them, five couples, right, in each of the 10 divisions. Remember, there's 50 males, 50 females. And they're not initially pairing up for material procreation, but that, you know, happens down the road when they're ready to leave and material son and daughter arrive as the Adam and Eve. But recall, we already had them mentioning that they are active in these pairs and are producing the primary midwares in relatively short order after their arrival. So we got that. Remember, that was in the context in that immediately preceding section when they were laying out the threefold nature. They have their basic material, mortal nature that we understand, that like we have, with that additional circulatory system added, so that using the Tree of Life and connected to the energy feeds, if you will, of the Master Physical Controllers, they are immortal. It's obviously qualified immortality, not innate, like, say, a Lenonidex Sun, you know, or just innately immortal. This is all dependent upon those immediate mechanics of the way they were, their bodies were constructed here, that they need the Tree of Life. So there's that qualification. But then there's also, just like with the material son and daughter, even on Gerasim, except for the initial pair in each local system, but after that initial pair, they are... their immortality, even though they don't need a Tree of Life on Gerasim, that immortality is dependent upon their mind staying properly formed. It's a literal energy system. If it's twisted literally too far, it literally comes unplugged from those life-sustaining inputs from the Master Physical Controllers, and they become immortal. So when those members of the corporeal staff that joined the rebellion twisted their minds and in embracing the fallacies of the rebellion, when they did that, they came unplugged and became mortal, just like a material son or daughter does. So that reminds you again of how these bodies that they have are quite a bit like a material son and daughter, especially, like we mentioned, after you let them be influenced by that additional energy input over a long span of time, hundreds of thousands of years, the genetics begins to morph into something that's quite similar to a material son and daughter. So you have that twofoldness, and then don't forget that, you know, and that's what gives you the primary midwares, they have a full Marantia energy system body that they had on Gerasim that was transported here. And you know, they're not being divorced of that. That's being somehow interfaced in a very intimate way with their material bodies. So that's where we left it, giving us all those basic details. But it's, you know, it's now time to for them to shift the story to, it's like, okay, so we know kind of who's here and where they are and when, you know, but what about why? You know, why are they here? What about that civilizational uplifting role? You know, that's what they're getting into in a more direct fashion now with this section. Breaking up into these 10 groups, each of them taking on a particular aspect of the uplifting task, particular phase of civilization. Very, very rudimentary beginning civilization, yes, but trying to get them, to the degree that they can, bring some the originality of personality into play. And they're not just going along naturally as a fancy animal, right? But they start to get them to choose a little bit of unnatural originality, creativity, civilization. All right, so let's see what they've got here.
Section 5, Organization of the 100. The 100 were organized for service in 10 autonomous councils of 10 members each. When two or more of these 10 councils met in joint session, such liaison gatherings were presided over by Dalgastia. These 10 groups were constituted as follows.
Okay, so before we do number one, let's just consider the little preface details there. So autonomous, in other words, you know, basically self-governing. You know, it literally means self-lawed. You know, each of them decides within the group of 10 how they're going to approach their task, and they regulate themselves within that context. If they're going to work together in two or more groups, like they need someone superior to the group. So, and you notice it's not Caligastia, like we pointed out. Same reason that it's called Dalmatia, not Calamatia. Right, the Dalmatia is really Dalagastia is, you know, very much a hands-on individual of the two. Like I pointed out, you can kind of think of it as the thought is in the planetary prince, and the word, you know, the expression is in his assistant. Right, so Dalagastia is the one that's immediately engaging the groups when they need someone to, you know, be overarching the autonomy, you know, the relative autonomy that they have as groups. You notice that here they just use the general term council for all 10 of them. We'll see as we get into each of them, the author of the paper very cleverly selects you know, basically a synonym word to use in each context, just to further emphasize the flavor of that particular council. Now, you can see as you glance down that they just use that vanilla one council for this first one, but you'll see as we go forward they pick other terms. It's not, you know, you don't have to make sure that you say college if they say college for one of them, or what, you know, whatever. You know, you can just call them councils in general. But just, you know, they're always looking for little ways to to foster, even an unconscious greater synchrony with the truth of what they're trying to present, and subtle little variations of what word they use. It may not be so important to look at the etymology and try to get very analytic with it. It's more of a they're looking not so maybe much for the what it denotes, that word, but what it connotes. Right? The connotation might be important. Mm-hmm. All right. I said that because, I was expecting as we got into them, someone was going to say, well, why did they call it this time and that the other time? And that's why. Okay.
One, the Council on Food and Material Welfare. This group was presided over by Aang. Food, water, clothes, and the material advancement of the human species were fostered by this able corps. They taught well digging, spring control, and irrigation. They taught those from the higher altitudes and from the north improved methods of treating skins for use as clothing, and weaving was later introduced by the teachers of art and science.
Okay, now a lot of this is, it's fairly, on the surface anyway, factual seeming. But we'll pause nonetheless, almost always at each paragraph. If nothing else, allow a little bit of interaction that may flesh out some of the truth. You notice at the end that when they mention there's a group that's devoted to art and science, we'll get to here in a little bit. So some of the more sophisticated stuff is handled by that group. So there's probably these first ones are probably many times the more rudimentary issues. As you just glance at the italicized, little subheadings here, you can see that. We're starting out, we have the issues of the nutrition epoch and the security age. And so you can see right away that those foundational issues, there's an order to how they've put them here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, these 10 groups. It's not just an arbitrary order. There's measures of hierarchy or sequence, or whatnot that, you're immediately sensing there. Yeah.
Well, one thing I notice, and I'm able to bring it up later now, mm-hmm. is every single one of them has a three-letter name.
Yeah, that'll come up here in a little bit. We'll talk about the names here in a little bit. Well,
maybe it's because nobody could speak much.
We'll talk about that. When we get to group number four, we'll talk about the names. They're gonna be all three-letter simple names. So food and material welfare. Obviously, this one is most immediately focused on the nutrition. That's very first things, the nutritional epic issues. When you read it, it's like, well, what do they mean by material welfare? Well, okay, clothes and then material advancement. Well, what do they mean by that? Well digging, spring control, irrigation. Okay, so it's just one of those basic rudimentary issues of your material maintenance. Okay, so that's that. What that group is about. You see them. Even though it's just a little tidbit, they're just giving you enough where you can sort of fill in the blanks, by reminding you of, they're not just ministering locally, they're thinking globally, they have to work differently with those that are going to be at high altitudes or northern latitudes. You're going, well, what about southern latitudes? Well, remember, we're kind of localized yet. We don't. South America is not in play here yet. You could just fill in the blanks about all the other differentials about how they would work with something that's living in a more arid, you know, region. Then you might also say, well, you know, maybe there's not a lot of people that are living in too harsh of environments, at least initially, because, right, they have limits to how civilized they are, how much they can handle, you know, really difficult situations, you know, climatically. So all that stuff is just there by just throwing out a couple things. If your gears are turning, you know, you can just start to think about, okay, well, what if I was on that council? You know, what would the tasks be, you know, in front, you know, that would be in front of me? What challenges would I have to face? You know, what if you get to Gerasim and you haven't fused it to your adjuster yet? And they ask for volunteers and you get, you know, you volunteer and you get selected and you end up on some world, right, that hasn't, you know, reached inhabited status yet. You know, you actually get assigned to one of these things. Could you do the task? Could you be patient enough, objective enough, right, subtle enough, right, to not be a giant rock in the pond and disrupt it? You know, would you have overcome your tendency to instead of having properly spiritual idealism, a tendency to translate it to material idealism? Would you have enough control of that you wouldn't be falsely applying that spirit energy to these material issues and be pushing them too hard, saying things you shouldn't be saying?
Well, you wouldn't know what you'd do without your thought adjuster.
Yeah, and, right, and exactly, and you just took the punchline there, right. And you've got to do it all without your thought adjuster. Exactly. Yeah,
if they'd had their thought adjuster, they may not have... Yeah. Rebelled,
right, right. If you didn't have that little catalyst for your integrity like you have right now, if you had to stand on your own two feet in terms of integrity, are you integrous enough, right, to handle food and material welfare for 500,000 years without going stark raving mad?
I'm not
right? I mean, you know, you should be, you know, I mean, I'm throwing that out because you're going, every one of you should be recognizing humbly, no, I would definitely screw up. There's no way. I mean, I can't even comprehend it. You know, it's just that, you know, wouldn't I be just bored out of my mind, you know, the tedium of it? You know, for 500,000 years teaching these, you know, people, okay, now here's how you make a well, here's... Right, you know, and they don't get it, you know, over and over.
So you mean our thought adjuster would leave us for that stint?
Yeah, the thought adjuster is, you know, was disconnected on Gerasim, and you were stuck in a transport seraphim and all to that world, and
maybe yep. I'll do it. And think about it differently up there.
Now, see, again, remember, the whole point is, you know, what, you know, remember what I said when after we read that first paragraph? Doesn't this seem like it's kind of just factual, blah, blah, blah? Right, I mean, you know that's not the point. It's a revelation of truth. What's the, you know, besides the historical facts being disclosed here, what's the point of this? It's to get you to reflect. You know, this hits close to home. You could be in one of these groups. You know, and we're going to read about how they got impatient and went astray. You know, you should be thinking about that. Could I be patient enough, or would I end up in that limbo land like those rebel corporeal staff are right now? Still not. You know, their adjusters are still, you know, waiting for the resolution of the rebellion. And
you might have an advantage coming from this world.
Anyway, but okay.
It'd be an interesting thing.
Just that's the whole point is to not, you know, to try to find the truth. How does this impact me very deeply, personally, intimately? What's the truth of this? you know, the details of teaching well digging to Homo erectus is, okay, is not the immediate thing you're looking for.
The other thing, this is rudimentary civilization, but the elements are still pertinent today.
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is, we haven't advanced that far.
Yes, right. That's the next thing. You see that, you know, that comes up as you get into this paper a little bit further. You're going, well, you know, actually, as I read about this, aren't we still basically doing this? We still have to go to Africa and teach them well digging and, you know, and yeah, right? Because, of course, there was a rebellion. So many of these things still haven't been done, right, 500,000 years later. And so there's a relevance there, too. It's like, you know, how did they do it? How should we be doing it? We have this broad bell curve, right, of development on this planet. How should the more developed people be engaging the less developed people? Should we engage them like this prince's staff did after Lucifer gave him these great new ideas? You know, as you read forward in this paper, you just go, oh my goodness, that's exactly what a lot of us are doing. We're repeating the same thing that they did 200,000 years ago, thinking that we're enlightened and we should... Yeah, no. I mean, see, unwittingly, you know, you discover unwittingly, lots of our people have already joined the Lucifer Rebellion and are doing exactly what the prince's staff did 200,000 years ago. You know, in the name of, you know, trying to help the people in the undeveloped countries.
Yeah. The longer view that this group or any of the administrators have, it's like they can see that just even well digging or irrigation, how essential it is for the development, because that has to be first.
Right, exactly.
You can see all the way, way down to where finally you get to some light in life and how this builds.
Yeah, that's the key right there. You know, in translating it from a horizontal, you know, down the road sort of a thing, you know, and these are the first steps, you know, think about it vertically, right? Because it's a civilizational uplift. Right? And you can't lay the penthouse of light and life if you haven't laid the foundations that are being laid here. Yeah, so again, that brings it around, you know, our imaginings about, I'm pretty sure that 10 years from now, something cool is going to happen. We're all going to be enlightened life. No, we haven't even laid the foundations yet. You can't build the penthouse. It teaches that patience again. Okay, let me get that last little chunk in there.
Great advances were made in methods of food storage. Food was preserved by cooking, drying, and smoking. It thus became the earliest property. Man was taught to provide for the hazards of famine, which periodically decimated the world.
All right, so just a simple little thing, something that can actually transcend the moment, right? The earliest property, right? Beef jerky, right? Doesn't exist for 5 seconds, right? It goes on to the next day or the day after that, right? You know, and you can say, this is my beef jerky, and that's your beef jerky. That, you know, that's getting going. You know, but just think about it. When they're just eating raw meat, right? I mean, that's just in the moment. Right? And so food, you know, it's more than just keeping them from starving to death. You're using that immediate need for food to start eternalizing their consciousness. Start to get them out of the moment. Simple things like preserving food starts to get them, you know, especially to use their personality. Remember, that's what they're fundamentally trying to get them to do, you know, so that they don't just have a present and a past, but they start to project forward to the future. And only it takes your personality to look forward into a future. No animal has any future in their consciousness. They just have a present moment and a past in their memories. And so that's the thing that you can recognize in there. Ah, see, in that subtle little way, it's encouraging personality usage. And then the other little thing you can't help but wonder, you know, they obviously decided to say decimated the world. And you're wondering, should I actually think of it not in, you know, in metaphorical terms, but in direct terms? I mean, are they saying, yeah, and periodically, you know, 10% of the people died of starvation. Yeah, probably yes. You're probably supposed to be thinking of the literalness of that word, you know, and, you know, 10% might be on the small side, you know, at times, I'm sure. You know, it could be massive death from famine. All right, so that, see, that's the most of them are kind of like that. It's just on the surface, just the words are, you know, you could read in 30 seconds and blow right on to the next one. But you'll notice they're always breaking it up, you know, into multiple paragraphs, trying to get you to pause just because there's a paragraph break and step back and reflect a little bit and try to recognize what goes beyond the immediate facts tied to the words. All right, so we don't want to labor this, you know, belabor this, but you see, that's what you're supposed to be doing here with this. Now, spend some time yourself reflecting. I can't reflect for you, no matter how many words I say, is not one measure of reflection on your part, right? You can't get reflection vicariously through me.
Well, that's it.
That sounds like work. all right, so what do we have for group number two here?
Two, the Board of Animal Domestication and Utilization. This council was dedicated to the task of selecting and breeding those animals best adapted to help human beings in bearing burdens and transporting themselves, to supply food, and later on to be of service in the cultivation of the soil. This able corps was directed by Bonn.
Okay, so just, you know, a little bit building upon the foundation of just the immediacy of the nutrition epic, see? Right? I mean, still quite a bit involving food or the production of food, but, you know, building upon that, you can see. So, yeah, I mean, it should be obvious that there's an order to these. You know, you definitely have a logical sequence to this set of 10 groups here. And they're building one upon the other. So, you know, you're thinking, oh, it's kind of like the adjutants, right? The second adjutant builds upon the foundation of the first adjutant, you know, et cetera. Similar sort of thing.
It seems like that whole thing was successful the whole time. Successful, you know, you think of the 1800s and that went well.
Yeah, and you know, you'll kind of see here in the next paragraph why we go, you know, man, we've done a lot of animal domestication, and you notice the not arbitrary selection of words there. This council was dedicated to the task of selecting and breeding. Oh yeah, like selective breeding. yeah. So the basics of selective breeding, you know, were put forward a long time ago. They're relatively straightforward. They weren't lost so much in the wake of the rebellion, because, you know, people got that. It's like, oh yeah, well, yeah, you know, they didn't forget that. They could continue that on, you know, and so, you know, now we've got dogs of every shape and, you know, and size and whatnot. Okay.
Chris,
yeah?
That was primarily farmers that remembered that, wasn't it?
Right, right. And see,
I mean, even today.
And again, see that, and that.
They're the conservative, you know,
right, that conservation of things is,
you know, because they're close to the land.
Because they're close
to the
land. Exactly.
They don't
exactly
fly off.
Yeah, exactly. See, that's the whole point.
You can
see that. However, you know, a little spoiler, Bon and this group all joined the rebellion.
Yeah.
But, see, still, I mean, we're at a rudimentary enough level. You know, food. We all have to have food, and we, you know, so we could hold on to, you know, these rudiments reasonably well. Let's see, anything else there? Yeah, let's keep going.
Several types of useful animals, now extinct, were tamed, together with some that have continued as domesticated animals to the present day. Man had long lived with the dog, and the blue man had already been successful in taming the elephant. The cow was so improved by careful breeding as to become a valuable source of food. Butter and cheese became common articles of human diet. Men were taught to use oxen for burden-bearing, but the horse was not domesticated until a later date. The members of this corps first taught men to use the wheel for the facilitation of traction.
So this is that last one first. Like, oh, okay. So it's starting to bring in a little bit of technology when you bring in, you know, not just domestication, but the utilization, as they mentioned there in the little heading. So the wheel goes way back, right? And we were helped to recognize that. But you notice another element, like I said, about why this, you know, the whole bit of selective breeding and whatnot and taming of animals wasn't, you know, completely disrupted by the rebellion. It was going on solidly, to a degree, before the prince and his staff arrived. See, that whole bit with the dog, and even the elephant with the blue man. And of course, remember, the blue man hadn't been around long. I mean, the prince and his staff are arriving, you know, right around the time that the Sangiks are coming into existence. But they're obviously hinting at that, you know, humans were picking up on this stuff on their own. So there's a naturalness to it. That, you know, just the basic insight we have, the common sense we have with the encirclement of the Holy Spirit was getting this going a bit. They throw in little tidbits like, you spent all this time working on the breeding and domestication of certain species, they go extinct, because this is starting way back. And I remember when we were going through those final phases with mammals, like for instance in North America, there's all kinds of mammals that, you know, are not here anymore, you know, have gone extinct since humans started up. So, right, so you have that issue in play as well.
Chris?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, also they're highlighting the blue man. Remember we said in the previous paper, you know, they were a great race, they said, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's just because it pertains to us more or because they did things that the other colored races couldn't do.
The blue man has because he favors the fourth adjutant, that individuality adjutant that, in many ways, more innately grounded adjutant. They're pointing out that it's not a coincidence that he's able to kind of naturally get some of the things that those very rudimentary Andonites were getting with the dog going way, way back. Okay. So, yeah, there's always a logic to why, it's blue man and not red man, say. Yeah, and you can, just a little bit of reflection allows you to recognize that. Yeah. You'll see that very definitively as we get down to number four here. The other little thing they throw in there, remember that the horse wasn't significantly domesticated until the Andites, right? Until well post Adam and Eve. So you have kind of an interesting question there. Well, why Why were they not fostering that early on? You remember with the Andites, that starts to bring in some issues. You know, you want them to be a little bit slow moving to begin with. You don't want them getting too heading towards the horizons right away. But of course, the flip side is they also don't have the Adamic uplift, so they don't have a lot of tendency to want to go zooming to the horizons. So there isn't a fascination. It's like, wow, look how fast that horse is going. If I got on top of that thing, I could go to the horizon and lickety-split. See, that those gears are not turning. They're much more place-like, just Sangic peoples. Right? So that's not going to fascinate them, the idea of going fast. You know?
They're scared of going fast.
Right? Right, they may actually be quite fearful of going fast.
Is that Fandor by
name? Yeah, that's coming up here. You keep jumping ahead. Well, that's the next paragraph.
He likes to go fast.
Yeah, so you'll see that there isn't the horse, but there is something that does go fast. Let's get the next paragraph here.
It was in these days that carrier pigeons were first used, being taken on long journeys for the purpose of sending messages or calls for help. Bond's group were successful in training the great Fandors as passenger birds, but they became extinct more than 30,000 years ago.
So it wasn't all mammals. No, you got birds. That whole bit of carrier pigeons, you know, that's where we got that. You know, if you ever wondered, you know, how did humans get into that curious thing? It seems so kind of out of the blue. Well, it's because it came out of the blue from the prince's staff way back. We were taught that we could use carrier pigeons, you know, and you can imagine how handy that is. You're way off somewhere and you're in a tough situation. You need to call for help and you can't pick up your cell phone, right? But you can attach a little note to a carrier pigeon, and back it goes. And then, you know, when they say that they trained the Fandors, you know, your first thought is, well, are they just using them themselves, the prince's staff, and, you know, the immediate people working with the prince's staff? Are these getting generalized into use? Maybe both, but maybe with the prince's staff first, because again, there might be issues of fear. Not only you're going to go fast, but you're going to be way up high, and you know this. You know, as I'll mention, for people who have a lot of very catatonic-inducing primitive fears, it may have been a little bit much for them early on to wrap their mind around. Okay, but there you go again. It's just, it's all very kind of matter of fact, but you know, we already obviously saw all kinds of things about how that helps us to appreciate where we are today. Like I said, we don't have to belabor it. You know, read this yourself and see how many original thoughts you can have of your own, is like ramifications of what they're saying, parallels to what they're saying.
The Fandors are like, the eagles are coming.
Yes, right. Yeah. We all know that they may have gone extinct more than 30,000 years ago, but they were there in legend, right? So that when Tolkien, writes Lord of the Rings, say, right, that's part of that northern white race, legendary material. Along with elves, tied to secondary midwares and all that sort of stuff. Right? Yep. So, all right. So that's the other fun thing, of course, like we mentioned, is that, and they'll bring it out directly here again, is how much this illuminates. Oh, well, that's where that mythology came from. Right? That's always kind of fun to just appreciate that there's a basis in fact of that. It is genuinely mythology. It isn't just pure fancy, some of these stories we have. All right. Notice that they called this one the board of animal domestication and utilization. But then they immediately said this council. See, so it's not like you have to call it the board, or or you're in violation of your precision or something. But just, you notice they tweak the word, and you can reflect on how our usage of those words has some connotation that is in each of these areas. All right.
Three, the advisors regarding the conquest of predatory animals. It was not enough that early man should try to domesticate certain animals, but he must also learn how to protect himself from destruction by the remainder of the hostile animal world. This group was captained by Dan.
Okay. Kind of interesting to use captain there. And these are advisors. That's interesting to just highlight that as being more of the relationship, as opposed to kind of more teachers, say, right, but advisors. But also the thing that strikes you is like, wow, so one of the 10 groups is devoted just to that. I mean, is that really a broad enough, domain of subject matter to devote a whole one of the 10 groups to? You'll see here in a second when you read the next paragraph. Right, this has connotations. It's not just about how you want to explain to them that lions have sharp teeth and you might want to not get too close to them. Right, I mean it's not it's a little bit simpler than the advisory signs at the zoo. That these people are overseeing.
I have a question.
Yep.
So are we supposed to conquest these kind of animals? Because we haven't, it's still a problem.
Right, and you know that there's areas of the world where people are still getting eaten.
We don't eradicate them though, do we?
Yeah, so we've talked about that. This whole, so you see the strong words, you see captained, you see conquest, we've talked about this in a number of contexts. I mean, there, you're not strolling around in the gardens of Edentia and get eaten by a hungry lion. Right? They told you point blank. There's no animals at all on those architectural worlds of any sort that will hurt you in any way. When a world is settled in light and life, obviously, especially with, as it gets in deeply into light and life, it's going to be quite a bit like an architectural world. So at some point, there aren't ravenous carnivores on this planet. Now, do they literally not exist anymore? Are they been modified into something that's not carnivorous? I mean, how much genetic engineering, do we have? How much do they just cease to exist? They already mentioned all these animals they domesticated and have gone extinct. Lots of, a lot more animals have gone extinct than are alive today. Right? Going extinct is not a big issue. A lot more could go extinct. That's a possibility. They may be going extinct right now and we're desperate trying to save them and it's a losing battle because the mother's not upholding them anymore. So no matter how many billions we pump into it, they're just going to go extinct. She's not upholding that species anymore. There's all these issues we have to try to figure out. Obviously, there has to be wisdom to this. We can be told kind of where we're headed, but exactly what's all the details to get there? I mean, you can't just go out and kill them all right now. You're going to upset the ecological system, right? So there's all these, we have to do what the prince's staff would be doing, making sure that they are not, that all their actions are not an affront to the evolutionary process. We have to recognize the evolutionary process and learn how to synchronize wisely with it. But more and more, that evolutionary process has an intimate personality management, right? See, you know, your personality actualizing is an evolutionary process. It's part of evolution. It evolves into expression.
Eat so, wisdom. Right. Don't leave your food and your yeah. sleeping in the right. mountains around here.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, it's a
just
not going, not even going to the second paragraph where it's kind of very immediate, you know, how this particular council could have something to do on an ongoing basis. Just projecting forward in time. I mean, this is a giant, huge issue. How do you manage the plant and animal life on a planet as it goes towards light and life? This is obviously a giant issue. And you're going, well, this group is going to basically leave the planet when the Adam and Eve arrive. Oh, yeah, that's right. Adam and Eve take over that job, helping us with the management of the plants and animals. Yeah, so, yeah, it's actually a very big issue.
What do you mean by the mother's not, I mean, I know in the larger sense, but how does that... I'm thinking of the Supreme. Am I off base there? The mother's not upholding it anymore?
Yeah, I mean, in the biggest sense, it's the Supreme, it's the mother facet within the Supreme.
Yeah.
But, you know, taking it down locally, immediately the upholder is our creative Mother Spirit.
Mother Spirit, okay. Right. So she'll be in yeah. tune with the facts of our universe and also experimental worlds because,
yeah.
you know, I think of the Supreme as, well, if I do it to one, I've got to do it to all of them. Mm-hmm. Let go, you know, all the planet.
Yeah, but you know, there's a specificity, like we talked about, you know, when we were leading up to this, the mind, you know, you don't just have the same flavor of mind
right.
across the whole local universe. It's brought into specificity, including right down to the world. And, you know, you're just recognizing there's a specificity even within that. I mean, the mother... the functioning of Mother Deity has a specificity to it, even though it isn't father-like micromanagement. Mm-hmm. You know, it can engage lots of specific parts, but it does it collectively and not this part and then this part. You know, it can engage all the parts simultaneously, but it does engage parts
right.
as a specific part. I mean, the way mind is being ministered to me is different than the way mind is being ministered to you, and it's being ministered by the same divine minister. She has to tailor her adjutant ministry to me, and then to you, and then to you, and then to you, and every single being is, she is specifically ministering to you differently, right? On an ongoing basis. She knows you intimately, right? Down to the molecular level. Right? She's attuning her mind ministry to synchronize with you.
So she's attuning to basically our genetics.
Yes, she is, yes. Yeah. And then she's, but it's not like she just attunes and then she can go, you know, go off and do something else. I mean, she's in there every nanosecond, intimately varying her engagement to you because you're constantly being stimulated by environmental stimuli and you know, you're constantly adapting. I mean, your mind is adapting. She's adapting. She, you know.
That's why she absolutely has to stay put.
Yeah.
This universe here.
Yeah. And so.
Try not to be high maintenance.
But no matter how high maintenance we are, she can keep up with it. She can handle it. You know, she's individually ministering mind to every single celled animal in the local universe. And remember, if you think, no, she's not. Yes, you can't. Remember, you can go to the facilities at the local universe headquarters and dial up exactly how she's ministering mind ministry to a specific single-celled animal. Anywhere in the local universe, you can look it up. And what the quantity and quality is of her ministry at that moment. I mean, it's just, you know, crazy, amazingly complicated. Okay. So, Captain Baidan, again, three letter name. All right, what else does it say?
The purpose of an ancient city wall was to protect against ferocious beasts as well as to prevent surprise attacks by hostile humans. Those living without the walls and in the forest were dependent on tree dwellings, stone huts, and the maintenance of night fires. It was therefore very natural that these teachers should devote much time to instructing their pupils in the improvement of human dwellings. By employing improved techniques and by the use of traps, great progress was made in animal subjugation.
Ah, okay, so the whole dwellings thing is in play. So that there you see just very immediately, and you notice how they emphasize that, that these teachers should devote much time, right, to instructing. So where the teaching comes in contrast to just the advising, is when you get to various, you know, arts of civilization, like dwellings. There's the wall again, remember? They put that right up front. You know, step one, when you build a planetary headquarters, build a very, very high, big wall.
40 foot?
Yeah.
It's the first mention of the wall, the first revelation.
Yep. One of the fundamental element of the first epical revelation is wall building. I shouldn't have to go on with that very far. Okay, but just I'm sure you were thinking, yeah, there's all the benighted masses out there, but you know, I mean, a lot of it is just all of the ferocious beasts, especially going way back. There's a lot of the bigger ones around. Right? There's all these different species of elephants, you know, rampaging everywhere, and all these big mammals still. Not some of the super, super huge ones, but still lots of quite large animals.
Even today, I got to use traps and walls to keep the varmints out of my garden.
Yeah, right.
Doesn't work.
You know, and then you get to that politically incorrect stuff there at the end of words like traps. And then just to add insult to injury, what's the final word? Subjugation.
Not equal with us.
Yeah, they're not equal. Yeah, so you have to somehow allow for words that we have tried to expunge from usage, like subjugation, but have wisdom. Obviously, if you're going to have the word subjugation, the fact of subjugation in play, without wisdom, you're going to have problems. You know, any strong thing, like the word discriminate, right? If there's no wisdom, that's going to lead to problems. Well, you know, because it's sad to record, there's almost no wisdom on the planet. No wonder words like discriminate or subjugate, right, have gotten a bad rap. Right? It's not because they're innately bad. It's they're not being used wisely. We shouldn't have to, you know, pound on this. This should be pretty straightforward, just how these are areas that we're all wrapped around the axle, and, you know, really need to back up and get more objective and reconsider some of these things. All right, let's see. I guess we got everything there, didn't we? One little noting. How rudimentary things are starting out, that they're hinting there, you know, tree dwellings, stone huts. Right? Again, they eventually point this out directly. You know, remember how evolutional their ministry is. And so how rudimentary it starts out. Right? They're not teaching them how to build, stainless steel structures or something, right, from day one.
So one of the 100 could have been attacked by a saber-toothed tiger and get killed, right? They weren't immortal that way, right?
Yeah, it's not that, yeah, they weren't magically immortal, right? They were damageable.
So
they have to be careful. Yeah, I mean, I mean, initially, you know, if you just, it's a selfish thing to build a wall. It's like, you know, okay, if you're going to haul me from Gerizim, stick me in this this material body and plop me into a bunch of, in the midst of a bunch of ferocious beasts, first thing I'm going to do is build a wall. Okay? That's the wisdom of Gerizim.
How hostile is it?
It's going to be many years before I build a helicopter.
Yeah.
Moving in the trees.
Yeah, but definitely, initially, right? The whole point is to protect themselves.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So again, but it's still, you know, very. You know, we have the nutrition epic and the security age stuff. See, basically, you can see. We get to number four. Okay, now it's going. Now it's getting a little bit more sophisticated. Okay, not quite so much of the rudimentary first two developmental epochs.
Four, the Faculty on Dissemination and Conservation of Knowledge. This group organized and directed the purely educational endeavors of those early ages. It was presided over by FAD. The educational methods of FAD consisted in supervision of employment, accompanied by instruction in improved methods of labor. FAD formulated the first alphabet and introduced a writing system. This alphabet contained 25 characters. For writing material, these early peoples utilized tree barks, clay tablets, stone slabs, a form of parchment made of hammered hides, and a crude form of paper-like material made from wasps' nests. The Dalmatia Library, destroyed soon after the Calagasia disaffection, comprised more than 2 million separate records and was known as the House of Fad.
Yeah, so forget about the Alexandria Library.
Wow.
How about the House of Fad? Imagine if we had the House of Fad. Written records from 500,000 years ago. Wouldn't that be cool? And then the other thing you see there is, okay, there's definitely some basic material arts of civilization issues. With, you're going to write, you got to write on something. What else do you have there? Like I said, you can see we're beginning to push into the rudiments of a material comfort era here.
Faculty.
All right? And just that word, faculty, to use that word, faculty now. You can note, there's a lot of these, you note the pair, you know, it's dissemination and conservation, so your foundational element there is the conservation, and remember, conservation is not preservation, right, they're opposites, right, temporally, preservation is pointed to the past, conservation is pointed to the future, the future again, see, it's fostering that personal manifestation, recognition of the future that a person has. Notice the other very clever little simple thing to foster the actualization of personality. The educational methods of FAD consisted in supervision of employment. You got to step back and reflect. Right? Supervision, right? Get top down, see it from above, reflect. See, it's simple little things that, you know, he doesn't have to give a lecture on reflective thinking, right? He just gets them to add that little element to the basics of what you're doing, to think about stepping back and consider, it's like, well, could we do this in a different way? Is this the most efficient way to do this? You may recall that they mentioned that men long had a natural stimulus towards developing efficiency and things because of war. You know, war was a harsh teacher for the soldiers of war. How to be more efficient, you know, to step back. It's like, okay, that didn't work at all. Is there a better way to approach this? It starts with very rudimentary things like that, very harsh things, you know, even. But you get reflective thinking going at a rudimentary level. See, it's not just instruction and improved methods of labor, right? You're not just making, you know, they aren't just training fancier automatons, fancier animals. Right? We all know you can teach an animal to do a lot of tricks, right? You know, there's some of that, but there's also a personal element, reflective thinking.
Chris,
yep.
In a pejorative way, this is also the beginning of our history of the man, so to speak. You hear it in a lot of songs, you know, back from the late 60s and stuff.
Mm.
You know,
yeah, right.
You know, and it's kind of in a negative way, you know, the man.
Sure.
Get away from the man, and he ruined my life.
What's one of the four indispensables to the progress of early civilization? Social classes. Right? You got to begin to develop a social hierarchy. That's one of the indispensables to the progress of early civilization. Right? Remember that there's a reason why our alphabet is in the ballpark of the number of letters that it is, right? You know, it started with 25, and then there was one with 24. I mean, English has 26. I mean, Greek has 24, right, still, et cetera. That's, it all got started in that neck of the woods in terms of the number of letters by fad. And it became a fad, pardon the pun.
That sure
and,
was a big step.
Yeah, it's a huge step. Yeah, and this is why I told you we needed to wait until number four for them to bring up the alphabet, because there's something very glaring that that you can notice as you look at all 10 groups. You know, and one of the first things that you're noting is who's the head of that group. You know, look at this. We have Ang, starts with A, followed by Bon, B, right? Dan, D, like, wait a minute, that seems like it's like alphabetical order. Yeah, look at it. It's two things. First of all, you go, wait a minute, it goes to N after F, it goes to N, and then it goes back to H from nod to hap. Oh, but notice if you take nod out, it is in alphabetical order all the way from Ang to Van. Or another way to look at it, it's in alphabetical order for the first five, A through N, and then for the second five, from H through V. So that's one of the things that jumps out. Oh, it's. I bet you kind of have two sets of five, just because of that. But you're thinking, well, or. Let me look, maybe, let me not just go by that, but you actually study them, and you see, you definitely have two sets of five. You have nod as the culminating one for the first set of five. That's why he became the leader, right? Because he's in, you know, he's in that sort of cherry on the top of the first five. And then Van is, you know, the last of the second five. See, so definitely... Right, you have two groups of five, with Nod kind of capping off the first one and Van capping off the second set of five. But back just to the alphabet, you know, you can't help but wonder. They aren't making up these names. It's like, well, how do you know? Well, remember, we have Lake Van still to this day. Right, that was his actual name. Okay, back 500,000 years ago. You know, when Andonites jiggled air molecules, they said Van to address him. Okay, so this is, you know, we noted there's a definite sequence these, and so you're seeing that the names in that order as well. Ang, Bon, Dan, etc. and how close that is even to the English alphabetical order today. And one of the things you wonder that is, well, do you suppose? I mean, the fact that they are almost like in that sequence, except for not. Do you suppose back in that 25-letter alphabet, do you suppose N was in between F and H instead of after M back then? Maybe this actually was that alphabetical order in the 25-letter alphabet that Fad formed. Because, it seems highly suggestive, right? And you were even noting something about, you have Ang, A-N-G, N and G is before H, yeah. one could wonder. Now, then the other thing is, all of them are what I used to, tell the kids was sort of a simple word. I had a consonant, a vowel, and a consonant. Right? Nod. Van, right? Fad, etc. Right? Except Ang. Right? Ang is different, so that's kind of curious too. Why is the first one? It's got to start with an A. It's got to be, well, why didn't it start with B? They skip the vowels in the other one. There is one that starts with E or right, O or.
It was a Vedic Indian god.
Right, and we know that some of these, it's not just Van, some of these, carry forward in other ways too. There's all sorts of interesting stuff just in the names.
Remember, did
Fad
go into the rebellion or not?
So I'll start pointing out. Ang and Three stayed loyal. So four of the ten there stayed loyal. All Bon and the whole crew joined the rebellion. Dan and the whole crew joined the rebellion. Fad and Five, the Fad Five, right? The Fad and Five stayed loyal. So you have 40% and 60% for those two. And then I'll point them out as we go through the other ones. So you have a measure of loyalty, two disloyal, and then a loyal, a measure of loyalty in the four we've done so far.
I would just think that somebody did the library would stay loyal.
But... Yeah, but then again, you're thinking, well, shouldn't there be more loyalty the farther you go? So it's not that simple. Yes, we definitely see there's a sequence here.
It says somewhere that the blue man was the most susceptible to the rebellious.
Right there.
Could be because of the relationship.
There's a bunch of issues, yeah. Yeah. Obviously, the closer identification they had with the staff, the more likely they could, be led off on a tangent by the staff. Yeah. That's just a fun thing to think about with the fact that these are their actual names how you've got... isn't it interesting that it's basically the same alphabetical order as we have in the English alphabet? I'm sure the... there's some issues there under the surface that linguists and stuff, will be very interested to reflect on, in the future. All right, let's get this. This is an interesting paragraph here.
The blue man was partial to alphabet writing and made the greatest progress along such lines. The red man preferred pictorial writing, while the yellow races drifted into the use of symbols for words and ideas, much like those they now employ. But the alphabet and much more was subsequently lost to the world during the confusion attendant upon rebellion. The Calagasia defection destroyed the hope of the world for a universal language, at least for untold ages.
We get a direct mention of the rebellion here, finally, in the midst of this. Plus with the bit about the library there being destroyed. He's going, well, why didn't they mention the rebellion before? Well, like I said, so you're starting to get something beyond just the nutrition epic in the security age. The higher it is, the more problematic it is when it falls. So see, it's you can see why they brought it in. They mentioned it directly here. It's like this is starting to be quite consequential. And it's not so much of an issue how many, you know, how much issue with group number one you had in the wake of the rebellion. But now we're seeing something that's beginning to get beyond the root, very material rudiments of civilization. Something that's a little bit more intellectual, right, is being lost. Something more definitively civilized is being lost. So that's why they brought up the rebellion here directly.
Chris,
yep.
Yeah, it could be some reference to the rebellion and how it operates and how it permeates through society. It doesn't permeate through action. First three are action-oriented things. They just, you don't do much thinking. You don't do much planning, discussion. You just act.
Again, remember, the so-called war in heaven is a philosophic war.
And the rebellion gets into that mindal level between the intent and the act and just rams its way through there.
Yeah, and so speaking about that mind element, you should be able to answer the why question. Why did blue man, red man, and yellow man have these differences of relationship to language? All right, that should be a straightforward little bit of reflection that you can do, knowing which adjutant they favor. Right? But of course, I'm going to lay it out. But okay, so blue man, right, is favoring that individuality adjutant, the fourth adjutant. So, of course, he's going to have a greater affinity to the individuality of letters, right? Something even smaller, more elemental than syllables, right? But all the way down to these little point facts of letters. His individuality favoritism likes to zero in on this letter, then this letter, and their linear sequence. Right, red man is a see how they did it in contrast. So you have individuality on one side, you have unity favoritism with the sixth adjutant on the other end with red man. Right, so he's going to favor pictorial writing. Right, the completeness of a picture.
Big picture.
Right, he wants to just like we always talk about. To bring in that picture on the wall, I don't go to the upper left corner and rasterize it and bring it in. One pixel at a time, left, right, top, bottom, right? I bring in all together, right? See, so his favoritism for unity consciousness has that preference for writing. Okay, so you have individuality on one end, unity on the other end, associativity in the middle. What does the yellow man wants to have associativity? He wants to associate symbols with words and ideas. He wants an associative thing. It's just that trivial thing. Individuality, associativity, unity. That's why they have that favoritism for writing.
Well, and then it goes on with, for at least untold ages. And when you think about it a little bit, the English language is definitely becoming more and more of an international language in this way, quite quickly, actually.
Yeah.
With an alphabet that's very somewhat similar. Here, and maybe the untold ages aren't going to be as untold, whatever that means. Who knows?
Yeah. Right. It's just. It doesn't mean untold. Doesn't necessarily mean long. It's just it's untold because there's all kinds of things. They don't know how many uplifters there's going to be. Get accelerated. But
they were originally teaching, an alphabet that obviously with their names and things like that we just talked about is probably a little bit more towards. The alphabet that is being used today in other than
And of course, you know, number five here, you know, industry and trade. I mean, commerce has an awful lot to do with getting a global language, right? Like they point out, it's not the visionary peace planning, right? That's going to have this tendency to begin to get us all on the same page. It's commerce.
My point also was, or my thought was, is that isn't it interesting just to know that even without these guys helping us, evolution...
What's the line? You know, I'm going to say it. What's the line? Or I paraphrase from Marriage and Family Papers. That which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution always achieves. Right? There you have it right there. Right?
It's interesting to see that, though.
Yep. And there's a simple example of it. Yep. Okay, see, so it's got that, it has that fun element that you can ask that why question. Why does blue man do that? Why does red man do that? Why does yellow man do that? You can answer that, and that's what you're looking for. That sort of recognition.
Primary colors too, I wonder if
that means. Right, and there's all the issues with the primary and secondary colors and stuff you can think about with the primary and secondary sangics, of course, yes. Yep.
This isn't the only place where it talks about the yellow man. And even Buddhism talks about drifting. You know, it uses right. that word.
Yep, right. I mean, again...
It could be an element of the mind.
You know, I mean, they, all the sangics, to a degree, are drifters. I mean, you need the biologic uplift. You need that directionization. Right? They're very place-like. They have different flavors of place-likeness, but when all is said and done... they're quite place-like. You know, some of them might be literally more static, whereas others are just net static, effectively static. I mean, they're racing around, but they're going nowhere. I mean, they're just chasing their tail around in a labyrinth. You know, and you know, so you know, the net effect is they're not going anywhere.
They're describing society.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of people that, oh, I'm doing all kinds of things. Are you really? I'm looking at you from above, and I haven't seen one shift in the gravitational center of all your motion. It hasn't moved one millimeter. You're just racing around the central point here. All right, number five. Oh, wait, is there...
I just, on that last sentence.
Mm-hmm.
The news, they're really getting into a debate about, is it even important, is language important to America?
Yeah, like I said, I shouldn't have to make a commentary on current events with many of these things. It should be trivially obvious to you how relevant so many of these things are, you know, and how unfortunate our opinions are on many of these issues. Right?
I hadn't heard that. I'm glad you
brought it up. There's a lot. Yeah, we have all these issues. Yeah. Anyway, that's...
I just say one other thing.
Oh, okay.
Even though I'm dragging it out, I remember when I went to grade school, my parents filled out the registration, you know, it was all in English. But when Jessica went, it had one side in English and one side in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And
Barbara, no, I mean, again,
Barbara, the ironic thing is that those people that support what you just talked about will say that you and the, those who believe the same as you are backwards.
Right, again, but again, of course, we know, right? Like I always point out, I mean, that's the problem. We lost our sense of true direction. So usually we, you know, the direction we think is forward is 180 degrees, right? It's actually dead backwards.
If you grow up in Europe, you got to learn five or six languages anyway.
Yeah. But anyway, right, we notice that, you know, initially you need to know a lot of language, but we know the goal is not more and more languages. The goal is one language. You don't get the light in life without one language.
Efficiency.
So, okay, let's keep going here.
Five, the Commission on Industry and Trade. This council was employed in fostering industry within the tribes and in promoting trade between the various peace groups. Its leader was Nod. Every form of primitive manufacture was encouraged by this corps. They contributed directly to the elevation of standards of living by providing many new commodities to attract the fancy of primitive men. They greatly expanded the trade in the improved salt produced by the Council on Science and Art.
So again, you've got the science and art, council coming into play there. But the thing that should, again, leap out at you is, the endless demonization of commercialization of our culture. Well, this commission, their job is to get everyone fixated on the latest bauble and making it and selling it and trading it. Right? Yeah. I mean, it's a fundamental part of how you get started. So just every one of these, you can see, like I said, if you took the material idealism that's quote-unquote conventional wisdom amongst us today and try to apply that in your job as one of the a prince's staff members on some other planet, right, you would be immediately in rebellion. Right? We have all kinds of unfortunate notions where we don't think in patient evolutionary terms. We want it all to magically be transcendent tomorrow. You have to kind of chuckle. So the leader of the rebels' corporeal staff, Nod, he was involved in promoting trade among the various peace groups. And of course, anything but peace resulted from the rebellion. It's an interesting irony. Yeah, so there's there's some interesting thing between the lines there, but just that whole I'm always joking about how we were attracted to shiny objects like a bunch of raccoons, but see that's part of it, right? To attract the fancy of primitive men. I mean, that's not an evil thing in us. That's God made us that way because that's part of how we start. You can't absolutely demonize such things. And again, the reason that people do that is because they're not keeping matter and spirit separate. Right? And instead of having true idealism, spiritual idealism, they have all this false idealism, material idealism. And it's a problem. Okay, what else do they say here?
It was among these enlightened groups, educated in the Dalmatian schools, that the first commercial credit was practiced. From a central exchange of credits, they secured tokens, which were accepted in lieu of the actual objects of barter. The world did not improve upon these business methods for hundreds of thousands of years.
If you put new wine in old wineskins when you're reading this, you seem to find a delightful affirmation. Yep, Nod was the leader of the rebellion. He was the one involved in the first commercial credit. Yep, money is the root of all evil. See how unfortunate, that low-hanging false fruit is there. Again, money is not the root of all evil.
Greed is good.
I mean, remember that it's the job of this corporeal staff during the normal material comfort era on every world, to be fostering that greed is is the way. Greed, gluttony. Remember all those excesses that we think of. Because you're trying to set up the contrast. Where you can recognize, no matter how hard you try, you can't make matter satisfy your spiritual consciousness. That's the whole point, is to learn by leaping, because you aren't, insightful enough to learn by looking yet in the material comfort era. So you have to learn by leaping. You have to take those good things to extreme, where they become bad. And those words good and bad are appropriate there. You're not just falsely applying them to material issues. Right? You're trying to make matter spirit. Right? And that's bad. Right? When you break the unity of genuine spirit relationship to your mind with the individuality of matter, right? That broken continuum, that's evil. That's bad. Okay, so anyway, back to the practical thing. They're teaching these very practical beginning things. It's very handy when you're bartering to not actually have to have a chicken in your pocket, right, that you pull out. You took the chicken to this credit dispensary. They're keeping the chicken for you in a pen. You took some little token. It's a one chicken token, and you have that in your pocket. Much handier, right?
Now you got bucks.
And it's a promise that, you know, it's like, oh, I don't know. I think I want to be able to touch the chicken again. This token is too abstract for me. I'm still pretty primitive, and I need tangible, direct things. You can race back, right, to the credit dispensary. Yeah, okay. I want to trade in my token. I'd like to have my hands on chicken again. Right. There's a promise that your chicken will be there if you want to trade it in. Just like if you wanted to trade in your paper note for some actual gold, you used to be able to do that.
Right there at the ATM.
So the central exchange, was keeping the chickens and the cows and the whatnot. And I couldn't help but notice your Freudian slip. The world did not improve. And you notice how you've had a Freudian slip of approve? See, we can't help it. We've been steeping in this. Money's the root of all evil. You know, industry and trade are evil. All this sort of stuff. I mean, it's very problematic. Okay, keep going. Now we got a college. Okay.
6. The College of Revealed Religion. This body was slow in functioning. Urantia civilization was literally forged out between the anvil of necessity and the hammers of fear. But this group had made considerable progress in their attempt to substitute creator fear for creature fear, ghost worship, before their labors were interrupted by the later confusion attendant upon the cessation upheaval. The head of this council was Hap.
Okay, so again, you know, don't get ahead of yourself. Oh, that fear of the Lord stuff, that is so horrible. No, that's a huge step forward to begin with, and it's taught. We were taught the fear of the Lord by Hap and his crew, right? Because it's a step forward from, ghost fear. Okay, so, and of course, how unchanged that remained. Religion is very conservative, right, in general. So the fear of the Lord that Hap taught is literally word for word in the Old Testament, right? All those years later. One has to read the other Anvil Hammer passages here. So notice, this one is the anvil of necessity and the hammers of fear. I'm so afraid, but I have to do it. I'm so afraid, but I have to do it. Right? See, right? That's the two things that are meeting there, the hammer and anvil meeting. Right? You have to overcome the fear. The anvil arrests the movement of the hammer. Right? The fear is arrested by just inescapable necessity. Right? Now, when they mention it, you don't have to go to them, but one of the other times when they do the anvil and hammer analogy is back in paper 23, section 2. I'll read you the whole paragraph here. The confusion and turmoil of Urantia do not signify that the Paradise rulers lack either interest or ability to manage affairs differently. The creators are possessed of full power to make Urantia a veritable paradise. But such an Eden would not contribute to the development of those strong, noble, and experienced characters which the gods are so surely forging out on your world between the anvils of necessity and the hammers of anguish. Your anxieties and sorrows, your trials and disappointments, are just as much a part of the divine plan on your sphere as are the exquisite perfection and infinite adaptation of all things to their supreme purpose on the worlds of the central and perfect universe. Do you see it that way? Right? Are your anxieties and sorrows equal in quality to the most sublime things that you can imagine in the central universe? So, I mean, how could that be the case? I mean, ask yourself that simple question. Right? Because, you know, they're just as much as a part of the divine plan. Those things are divine. Right, again, why does anything have value? Because of its actuality or because of its potentiality? See? All right, there's divine potentiality in your anxieties and sorrows, your trials and disappointments. Right, there's not divine actuality. Right, do you see them properly? Do you just judge them by their very imperfect actuality, or do you recognize the divine potentiality that's there? Do you see their value? Can you separate, again, spirit from matter? Okay.
What paper was that?
23. Yeah, it's in the Solitary Messenger paper. You know, notice here, So in the one we just read, we had the anvil of necessity and the hammers of fear, right? And here you have, again, the anvils of necessity. Although, I mean, here we just had the anvil of necessity. Now we have the anvils of necessity, so they're pointing out the complexity of it a little bit more. And instead of the hammers, you know, it was plural, hammers of fear. It's hammers of anguish, right? They take fear up a notch. Remember, fear is on the zeroth level, anguish, dread on the first level, awe and reverence on the second level of meaning, right? So it's basically the same thing, but just kind of amping it up even more, you know, to anguish. And then the other one is back in paper 9, Section 1, how Section 1 ends. To generalize this, the universe of your origin is being forged out between the anvil of justice and the hammer of suffering. But those who wield the hammer are the children of mercy, the spirit offspring of the infinite spirit. Remember how we chuckled about that one? We often do. So there it's the anvil of justice and the hammer of suffering. Again, you can just, you know, like necessity, right? I mean, there's the law. It's changeless. It just is what it is, you know, and you're pounded against it until you face it, okay? And you'll continue to suffer until you face the facts. And again, that one also reminds you of the more generalized things. Pain and suffering are essential to progressive evolution. And another way of kind of saying the same thing, that's the differential that powers.
Well, remember one of the first great questions in your book, does God suffer? Remember that? And Divine Counselor tries to answer that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a...
Yeah. So anyway, you just... You have to sort of consider all three together, the three anvil hammer passages. And, you know, again, it's just, you know, Jesus didn't teach the anvil hammer analogy. Right? It's just that's too rugged. See, but I'm stressing it because it just so much points out the differential between the fifth epical revelation and the fourth. You know, I mean, Jesus is trying to help the poor, struggling little people. Well, of course he did. Of course he did. Right? But he's, you know, he's presenting himself in many ways as kind of a buffer. He's the grace, right, in the midst of that. But here, you're courageously setting grace aside, you know, as a salve, and facing the facts. They're just presenting it to you directly. I mean, you know how that the universe of your origin is being forged out. There's no place that you can go to escape this. All right, so your religion of escapism is false. There is no escape. Right? Every nook and cranny is permeated by this fact. You've got to face it. And that's tough stuff. That's rugged truth. See, it's the rugged truth of the fifth epical revelation.
Jesus was rugged with the apostles. So
he was rugged with the apostles occasionally, yes.
He right. really forged them.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though they didn't get it. But
see, you know, so. But to the masses, no. Right?
That's what a lot of people want to go on, you know, for the fifth. You know, no harshness, no, you know, it's just all love.
Right, it's,
you know, continually ascending higher.
Right, yeah, see, and it's just the sweetness of affirmation.
Yeah.
And it's not. Okay, anyway, we got to be able to finish this up here. So, you know, isn't that interesting that, in bringing forward the College of Revealed Religion, that they put that in there. You know, ask yourself why. See, Hap and his crew have to keep that in mind because, okay, they're focusing on religion, so they could, you know, they're the spear point that could most easily get off on a tangent where they aren't keeping a balanced perspective. They're letting their bias towards their unity consciousness, right?
Are you going to rebellion,
Hap? No. Hap and everyone's, you know, Nod and everyone joined the rebellion. Hap and everyone stayed loyal. So again, see, that speaks to how well they could stay, you know, centered and grounded and not go off on those tangents, you know. You know, they're having to face these facts and minister in the context of those facts. They're not teaching pablum escapism to these primitive people.
I guess it's coming up the selection process with the 100.
Oh, yeah, that's coming up at the end, yeah. Yep.
None of the prince's staff would present revelation to complicate evolution. They presented revelation only as a climax of their exhaustion of the forces of evolution. But Hap did yield to the desire of the inhabitants of the city for the establishment of a form of religious service. His group provided the Dalmatians with the seven chants of worship and also gave them the daily praise phrase and eventually taught them the Father's Prayer, which was...
Before you read that, just a couple quick comments. See how they mentioned just what I was saying, right? That making sure that it's evolutional, what they're doing. This is where it has to be very, very, you know, careful in that regard. And we're not right now. And then notice, okay, you can't get them to the heights of genuine worship. You know, so you start with ritual. Now you see, basically, they're teaching ritual. You know, recognizing that way up superconsciously, yeah, there is genuine worship, right? But it's not going to be a conscious thing for a very long time. And so, if you wondered, how did we get so fixated on thinking worship is ritual? Well, Hap and his crew had a lot to do with that. But see, it got arrested. You know, they would have evolved it forward, and it's just kind of stuck in that early primitive mode. As they were just getting him started. The prayer he teaches them, again, he's kind of, it's like, you know, Jesus saying, all right, I'll give you a prayer. You know, Hap is doing the same thing. He's like, all right, I'll give you a prayer. Okay.
Father of all, whose Son we honor, look down upon us with favor. Deliver us from the fear of all, save you. Make us a pleasure to our divine teachers, and forever put truth on our lips. Deliver us from violence and anger. Give us respect for our elders and that which belongs to our neighbors. Give us this season green pastures and fruitful flocks to gladden our hearts. We pray for the hastening of the coming of the promised uplifter, and we would do your will on this world as others do on worlds beyond.
They were teaching about other inhabited planets right away. See, that's very interesting. How long did it take us to finally, you know, allow for that again, right? Not till the 20th century, basically. Now, remember, Father of all, whose Son we honor, Father, right? They're just teaching up to the local system level. So Father is basically the system sovereign, and Son, capital S, is the planetary prince. Right, so, you know, that's obviously Hap stressing this here, and then in the commandments, you know, see the prayer kind of summarizes the commandments a bit. You know, that's one of the reasons why so many people followed them off the cliff, right? They were taught as a religious duty, right, to not question what was going on, just blindly follow it. So they did. And then you notice at the end, they're tossing in, hinting about Adam and Eve showing up. So they, you know, the next paragraph explains that.
Although the prince's staff were limited to natural means and ordinary methods of race improvement, they held out the promise of the Adamic gift of a new race as the goal of subsequent evolutionary growth upon the attainment of the height of biologic development.
So they're teaching evolution, see, biologic development, the naturalness of dispensational suns and all that stuff, you know. We're having to slowly come around to allowing for. All right, the next group all joined the rebellion.
Seven. The Guardians of Health and Life. This council was concerned with the introduction of sanitation and the promotion of primitive hygiene, and was led by Lut.
Yeah, and so, and we all know it took us a long time to get any of that figured out through the evolutionary process. You know, we were dumping sewage in our drinking water till very recently. Right. Yeah, keep going.
Its members taught much that was lost during the confusion of subsequent ages, never to be rediscovered until the 20th century. They taught mankind that cooking, boiling, and roasting was a means of avoiding sickness. Also that such cooking greatly reduced infant mortality and facilitated early weaning.
Yeah, read the next one too.
Many of the early teachings of Lut's Guardians of Health persisted among the tribes of Earth on down to the days of Moses, even though they became much garbled and were greatly changed.
So, you see how the contrast there. Okay, you lost the truth of the teachings, but not the fact kind of this notion. And so you end up with all the Mosaic laws in the Old Testament that are, you know, garbled, you know, muddled, you know, notions along these lines. Such and so is supposed to be good for you, or you're supposed to do such and such with such and so, right?
Leviticus.
Yeah, all that stuff, right, in the books of Moses. Yep. So, again, it's like, oh, that's where that came from. I mean, we were just indoctrinated into this was important, and we lost all the proper specifics because of the rebellion, but we didn't lose the notion, and so we kept trying to perpetuate in kind of ritualistic fashion, see, amped up by Hap's teaching ritual. Yeah, so that explains all of that mysterious stuff that everyone knows about in the Old Testament.
A great obstacle in the way of promoting hygiene among these ignorant peoples consisted in the fact that the real causes of many diseases were too small to be seen by the naked eye, and also because they all held fire in superstitious regard. It required thousands of years to persuade them to burn refuse. In the meantime, they were urged to bury their decaying rubbish. The great sanitary advance of this epoch came from the dissemination of knowledge regarding the health-giving and disease-destroying properties of sunlight.
You could see how that would promote sun worship, see, even.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
Well, you know, nowadays it's a stay out of the sun. Diseases caused by the sun.
Yeah, but little beasties are killed by ultraviolet.
Number two, we're not burning refuge anymore. We're burying it. Seems to me we got Garbage Mountain out there by the airport. A couple of them. Yeah, they're all over the place.
You notice there's so many things you can think about from the practical standpoint. And then all of the superstition. You know, put yourself in this place. Could you spend thousands and thousands of years trying to convince them? Could you be patient enough, right, to convince them to burn their garbage? What long-term view you have to take. And we all know how fire, is a very fundamental element of a lot of religious thinking still. It's sacred. So the contrast, you take sacred fire and icky garbage, that's just sacrilege to put those two together. Mm-hmm. So you got all those difficulties they were faced with.
Do we talk about disease-destroying properties of sunlight today? For instance, give me a disease destroyer.
Ultraviolet light, like I said, kills little beasties because it's chemically active.
Yeah, you used to hang your laundry on the line out in the sunshine.
Yeah.
And that's what disinfected.
Yeah.
That's what cleans your laundry so it doesn't get all mildewy and gross.
You don't want the ozone layer too thick, or there isn't enough ultraviolet light to kill little beasties.
It sanitizes it, that's the word.
But it's just literally, it's just bullets. Those ultraviolet photons are just bullets that hit a little bacterium and kill it.
It just seems to be not in vogue these days.
Mm. Also, ultraviolet, I think, provides vitamin D.
Right, yeah, of course there's the vitamin D things and all that,
One of the most important of our vitamins.
Yeah. The health-giving, that's the health-giving thing there, But the disease-destroying, that's just the basic fact that ultraviolet light, kills things.
But there's always too much of a good thing, isn't it? It's not such a good thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, ultraviolet light, is, because it's, very... Because it's very chemically active, it doesn't have to actually have a living thing. It can break up just, non-living molecules, like very unfortunate collections of molecules like viruses.
Chris?
Yep.
The lower frequency light is blocked by, clothing. And the higher frequencies can go through it at nighttime.
Again, we're at a complete loss to understand the physics of having the dual circulatory system, and what that required and stuff. But okay.
Before the prince's arrival, bathing had been an exclusively religious ceremonial. It was indeed difficult to persuade primitive men to wash their bodies as a health practice. Blood finally induced the religious teachers to include cleansing with water as a part of the purification ceremonies to be practiced in connection with the noontime devotions once a week in the worship of the Father of all.
So, again, and we didn't, the humans didn't lose that. But see, just how did the water thing get into religious ritual? This is why. Because it was like, maybe we can, people love to be religious about religious, supposedly religious things. So let's make it a religious thing, quote unquote. Yeah, and then we can get them to bathe every once in a while.
You really need soap, though.
Right. But anyway, you can see how they're trying to illuminate here. Where did we get some of these notions? Why the religious fixation on water? Yep.
These guardians of health also sought to introduce handshaking in substitution for saliva exchange or blood drinking as a seal of personal friendship and as a token of group loyalty. But when out from under the compelling pressure of the teachings of their superior leaders, these primitive peoples were not slow in reverting to their former health-destroying and disease-breeding practices of ignorance and superstition.
Again, you know, have you ever thought, so it seems so arbitrary. Where did the handshake thing come from? All right. This is where. All right. You know, so, I mean, yes, Lut and all of his crew joined the rebellion, but a lot of things stuck. Right? We're still shaking hands today, as Lut and crew taught us to do. So if you just ever wondered, you know, why such a weird, arbitrary thing is custom. Okay, here's that art and science bunch that they've mentioned a couple times. And Mech and his crew all stayed loyal.
8. The Planetary Council on Art and Science. This core did much to improve the industrial technique of early man and to elevate his concepts of beauty. Their leader was Mech.
Yeah, again, just remember, see, it's art and science. You have the foundation of science, and art is upon that foundation. You know, it's predicated on, founded on science, and it's an attempt to reach up towards the Morantia. Right? But it's fundamentally a materially predicated fact, a fact predicated fact, right? If you will, even, right? Okay.
Art and science were at a low ebb throughout the world, but the rudiments of physics and chemistry were taught the Dalmatians. Pottery was advanced, decorative arts were all improved, and the ideals of human beauty were greatly enhanced. But music made little progress until after the arrival of the violet race.
Yeah, you just don't have that higher mind functioning that you need from the Adamic uplift. So it's... And it's just Sangeek, it's kind of bones on hollow logs, and it doesn't really go much farther than that. what was that?
Mech
default? No, like I said up front, Mech and everyone stayed loyal. Yeah. Yeah, it's only those two where there was, you know, it wasn't all disloyal or all loyal. That icky stuff that they, you know, you try to avoid in high school, physics and chemistry, no. if they had to face it 500,000 years ago, guess what? You're going to face it on the first Mansion World. Physics and chemistry. All right. You've got to have some basic grounding in material reality.
These primitive men would not consent to experiment with steam power, notwithstanding the repeated urgings of their teachers. Never could they overcome their great fear of the explosive power of confined steam. They were, however, finally persuaded to work with metals and fire, although a piece of red-hot metal was a terrorizing object to early men.
And to us, I think.
Very, very fearful, superstitious. You know, we always love to refer to this with just how mind-boggling it is. Steam power, 500,000 years ago. You know, how long did it take us to finally get around to steam power through evolution instead of revolution?
Industrial revolution.
Yeah, all the way to industrial revolution. Yeah, it's just amazing to think about that one. That was such a... you know, so when they say physics and chemistry, you know, it's not like in quotes. No, they mean physics and chemistry, right? I mean, steam power, for Pete's sake, right? Yeah, pretty amazing.
That gives you kind of a good concept or conceptual idea of where they were.
Yeah, I mean, not only is, you know, that explosive power, you know, but just remember... the fact, you know, of it being a vapor, right? I mean, what's God called? The breath of life, right? I mean, the word spirit, you know, et cetera, all those words, what do they literally mean? Breath, air, whatnot, you know, so, right, so it's very, you know, mysterious, you know, yeah.
It was really affecting in the Wizard of Oz, wasn't it?
All right, keep going.
Mech did a great deal to advance the culture of the Andonites and to improve the art of the Blue Man. A blend of the Blue Man with the Andon stock produced an artistically gifted type, and many of them became master sculptors. They did not work in stone or marble, but their works of clay, hardened by baking, adorned the gardens of Dalmatia.
Again, Blue Man, individuality, consciousness, favoritism. Can't read that last little chunk.
Great progress was made in the home arts, most of which were lost in the long and dark ages of rebellion, never to be rediscovered until modern times.
See, now that's a biggie, of course, right? Because the home, the family are so foundational to civilization. And that's why it has its own little paragraph like that, because it's such a key foundational element. Very sad to record, right, the loss of that for all those millennia. All right, and then Tut. Tut and everyone join the rebellion.
9. The Governors of Advanced Tribal Relations. This was the group entrusted with the work of bringing human society up to the level of statehood. Their chief was Tut.
Yeah, just keep going.
These leaders contributed much to bringing about intertribal marriages. They fostered courtship and marriage after due deliberation and full opportunity to become acquainted. The purely military war dances were refined and made to serve valuable social ends. Many competitive games were introduced, but these ancient folk were a serious people. Little humor graced these early tribes. Few of these practices survived the subsequent disintegration of planetary insurrection.
So you mean it's, you know, you can see immediately there's a lot besides just what you've probably first thought of when you heard tribal relations. Right, you've got all that stuff with marriage and family is very important in that. The whole bit of evolving war forward, and very important stuff there too, besides just kind of the basics of fostering, getting from tribes to nations to territorial states, like they said there at the beginning. So you notice bringing human society up to the level of statehood. Okay. So there is that basic clan, tribe, nation, territorial state framework that they're fostering the movement through, but you have all of the things, how important marriage and family is in that, and having less destructive outlets like games, competitive games, to replace for war. How long it took us to kind of bring that into play in a more definitive fashion. Yeah, but it's like, oh yeah, ancient Greeks were working on that, right? See, not all of that was lost. There was still some people working on doing those various things, even though Tut dropped the ball. Anyway, you can see all the kinds of things you can think about like that, right?
Tut and his associates labored to promote group associations of a peaceful nature, to regulate and humanize warfare, to coordinate intertribal relations, and to improve tribal governments. In the vicinity of Dalmatia, there developed a more advanced culture, and these improved social relations were very helpful in influencing more remote tribes. But the pattern of civilization prevailing at the prince's headquarters was quite different from the barbaric society evolving elsewhere. Just as the 20th century society of Cape Town, South Africa, is totally unlike the crude culture of the diminutive Bushmen to the north.
Two things there. Notice the use of the word coordinate, right? To regulate and humanize warfare, to coordinate intertribal relations. So not just thinking, in a purely relational sense, but thinking in that holistic, systemic sense, systematized sense. They're working to establish a system, not just thinking in these linear relational modes. And then, you know, you have to, again, just chuckle at the political incorrectness of the analogy there. But the importance of the challenge, right? I mean, you know, we've demonized the 20th Century Society of Cape Town, South Africa now almost, you know, absolutely. You know, okay, and there's some appropriateness, sure, you know, in comparison to our visualizations of light and life, there's much to demonize there. But see the contrast they're making. I mean, and how similar, you know, you take those Europeans and you plop them down there in South Africa and they carve out this little space, oh, like the prince and his staff were plopped down and carved out this little space and built a wall, and there's this stark contrast between what's inside the wall and what's outside the wall, you know, that apartheid setup. I mean, see, there's a place for that in getting things going. You know, it's like some Africans saying, well, you know, there was a lot of negative things to the colonial era, but at least the trains ran on time. You've got to appreciate, you know, you can't think in these simple binary terms, black and white terms, and it's like either it's all bad or it's all good. Or you need to think in evolutionary terms. And there's a place in the evolutionary process for the contrast between Cape Town and the Bushmen to the north. So, yeah, I don't think I need to beat that one again, but it's the challenge is, you know, it's almost nonstop when you get into the civilizational papers and the marriage and family papers. They're just constantly hitting you with this. You know how you have that simplistic absolutist notion where you think in dichotomous binary terms? No, you can't think that way. Right? You got to think in evolutionary terms. Stop judging things by their mere actuality. Right? Their value lies in their potentiality, not in their actuality. Yeah?
Chris, I think that in a further that analogy with, you know, the prince's staff coming into Cape Town or whatever, but the revelators are also trying to work with us and say the best way is to not go into their cultures, but build up a culture of our own,
yeah,
with the prince's staff and the Adamites, and then pick out and choose,
yeah,
the exceptional to come in,
yeah,
who want to be trained and who want to be sent back, yeah, to their own people. Yeah.
I didn't bring that up because that, yeah, comes up, you know, okay, later in the paper. Okay. That's one of the big things that they bring up. Yeah, it's a very important issue. Yeah.
Why culture, especially British culture, has done kind of the opposite of that. They've gone into these
right,
you know.
Yeah. Yeah, we all know how important that is. That's why the relators. Yeah, that's why the relators spend so much direct time on that issue. Yeah, yeah, it's a very important, yeah, element. Yeah.
They have a British name.
Yeah. So, right. We definitely want to talk about those kind of issues a lot when we get, you know, a little bit further in the paper. Okay. Just and then the final little cherry on top here, group number 10.
Supreme Court of Tribal Coordination and Racial Cooperation. This Supreme Council was directed by Van and was the Court of Appeals for all of the other 9 special commissions charged with the supervision of human affairs. This council was one of wide function, being entrusted with all matters of earthly concern which were not specifically assigned to the other groups. This selected corps had been approved by the Constellation Fathers of Edentia before they were authorized to assume the functions of the Supreme Court of Urantia.
Okay, so 2 things. One, just in the mode of how it fits in with the other councils here. So it's in the direct sense, like they're saying, this Court of Appeals. But notice it's also, there's a whole lot of other details. You know, any one of which is not big enough for a whole, you know, group of 10 to be focused on. So the other You know, all other issues are being handled by this group. So, you know, a lot of times you forget about that part of it, that there's a lot of down in the trenches details that they would have been dealing with too. There aren't just the guys up in the ivory tower that you might kind of think of them as. And again, you see that coordination. So they are supposed to be the sort of the most top-down vantage point group to foster the most holistic perspective on things. But then the other very important element that Chris was referring to a while back is right there at the very end. It's not a coincidence that Van and all of his crew stayed loyal. The Constellation Fathers handpicked that bunch for their innate integrity. They needed at least 10 that no matter what happened would not join a rebellion. They handpicked those 10 to be, you know, in all circumstances, sophistry proof. There has to be a backdrop, you know, an immutable backdrop to this whole picture, and that's that handpicked 10. Again, that's the job of the Constellation Fathers to see to that. So if you haven't recognized that in the past about that, right, there's nothing coincidental about Van being the one when all was said and done. He was selected by the Constellation Fathers to be that person that would stand unmoved. So that's a very, very important piece. And separate from, you know, being immune to rebellion, these 10, that innate wisdom, right, the consecration of their minds to the universal harmony of God the Mother that those 10 had, that's why they're being picked for the magnitude of that consecration, innate integrity of their mindful selves without an adjuster. That allows them to have this highest vantage point, big picture role in what they're doing. So that's the most immediate reason. They need to have that most objective mind. But coincidentally, right, there's also, just in case something goes off the rails, they are certain to be sophistry proof. They're not going to fall for anything. They have too much relationship to the other parent. Nod and crew did not. Right, they had lots and lots of consecration of their will, but when things got difficult, there they were, languishing and stumbling along in moral darkness. Yeah. So again, you see the fundamental necessity on this planet. We need more like Van and his crew. You need to be able to stand integrous, independent of your adjuster. Right? That's just, you know, cherry on top of the, you know, the sundae. Right? You need to have a mind that is courageously and independent of your adjuster even. You need to be able to stand courageously and independently on your own 2 feet. We need some more people like that.
So that gives the adjuster more to work with.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, the adjuster can do great things with such a mind.
Right?
But just appreciate how, you know, you're the one with the free will. You're the one that has to supply the favorable conditions. You're the one that the adjuster is subservient. And the adjuster is always subservient to your will. Right? So when all is said and done, see, Van and crew stand as the model. That's what you want to strive for, that kind of sophistry-proof and innate integrity of mind. All right. That's a tour de force to get through all 10 of those. And then like we were saying, we'll pick up on next time is, is, aside from all those specifics, in general, how are this corporeal staff, how are they managing the relationship to the people? Right? Do they just go out there, or, you know, how does this work? Like you were saying, you know, we all know, no, they bring in a select few and then send them back out again. And we'll talk about all the wisdom in that. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.